he's bossed around the whole episode. Like, no respect for him whatsoever. I was waiting for Horatio Sands to do a Rodney Dangerfield bit. It's like, I get no respect. Okay. No respect. Welcome to Death Watch, a serial watchcast about Disney's Star Wars The Mandalorian. I'm Mike Bennett.
And I'm Chris Cole.
And today, we'll be talking about Season 2, Episode 4, entitled Chapter 12, The Siege. This episode was written by series creator Jon Favreau and directed by first-time series director Carl Weathers.
So we know Carl Weathers because of his role as Greef Karga. And even though that this is his directorial debut for the show, it's not his first time behind the chair. He is, though, most famously known for his acting career. For instance, he played Apollo Creed in the Rocky movies, or as some of the Gen Z kids will know it now, as the Creed prequels. He's also known as CIA pencil pusher Dylan in Predator, as well as Chubbs, the one-handed coach in Happy Gilmore. As we mentioned before, there's also this cameo on Arrested Development where he goes, "Baby, you've got a stew going." So, a couple of fun facts. One of them is he was one of the original actors that actually auditioned for the part of Benjamin Sisko on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's cool. I would have loved to have seen him. I mean, the way it was cast was great, but I think it would have been cool to see him in that as well. So quick errors and omissions from last week. I was wrong. That was not the planet Mon Cala. It was the planet Trask, and it just happened to be filled with the natural residents of the planet Mon Cala, but you know, whatever. And I apologize on our live feed and other things, but I apologize for the audio quality last week. There's like a miscut of one of the sound bites from the show, and it overlapped, and you know, it is what it is, but sorry about that. So with that, why don't we go ahead and recap where we were. So in the last episode, we met the infamous animated character Bo-Katan Kryze from Rebels and the Clone Wars series. She makes her live action debut, and it was fantastic. Mando brings the frog lady back to this planet, reunites her with her husband, and in the meantime meets a group of Mandalorians. We learn more about how they're trying to take back the planet, and we also learned that Mando is part of a extremist sect within the Mandalorians who don't take off their helmets. They're called the Children of the Watch. And it was just kind of a pretty interesting, you know, mind-blowing episode in terms of information and character development. So at the end, Mando kind of sputtered off with a barely repaired ship, and it's clear he's going to need to get some repairs. So we'll jump into this week's episode. This cold open is like a classic Abbott and Costello comedy, and it's actually our first two-scene cold open, I think, where we've had kind of two scenes before the opening credits. But we open to Mando in space. He's kind of turning on and off some controls on his ship. He's obviously trying to, you know, restart something or fix something. And then he's calling back to the child, who's like in this really small access hatch tunnel thing, which I don't even understand how it is designed that way, because no normal adult alien would fit in there to make repairs. But this, like, this totally identified with being a parent of toddlers, and like the whole back and forth with Mando, like speaking slowly and like calmly, like, "No, pick the red wire and put it where the blue wire goes," and the child not doing it.
I mean, I also feel like this scene sort of went as expected. Yeah.
From the first moment, you knew what was happening.
He's gonna. I'm surprised he didn't blow up the ship, to be honest.
At least it was just a minor electrical burn, but that was a great bit. And so that ends with Mando saying, "Looks like we're gonna need to visit some friends," which you and I kind of thought this episode would end up with Mando going to Navarro to get the Razor Crest repaired. Well, we cut to Navarro we open up in the remains of the abandoned Mandalorian covert. It's kind of like the empty place where the Mandalorian mythosaur head was hanging above the entry. You can kind of see the old blacksmith area without the blue fire jet. It's like a red fire jet now, which kind of seemed like a good and bad, like light versus evil, blue and red kind of comparison.
Oh, I didn't catch that. That's a good...
Because we find out that this covert is now being occupied by a group of criminals who seem to be running some kind of illegal lava rat selling ring of some kind.
They've converted the furnace into their own personal stovetop.
Yeah, and we find out that Cara Dune has taken the role of the Marshal, which, you know, I think it's interesting that we get that name called back from the, you know, the Tatooine episode and Cobb Vanth's role in that town. And that's what she's doing here. And, you know, it almost seemed like they didn't even give her any like acting direction. They're just like, hey, can you just wrestle these people? We dressed up some guys in alien costumes. Go ahead and do some MMA on them, and we'll just film what you're doing. It's a pretty cool brawl. She's mostly just like flipping them and punching them. A couple of cool moments where she shoulders a guy to take the blaster shots that are coming at her. Her outfit is cool. Did you notice it? She like,
yeah,
the armor is like this like teal bluish color, which absolutely looks like the Sorgan clothing that the people who live in the village wore. That's like dyed with the krill blue colors. So I thought that was.
You think it's possible that she went back?
Well, you know, I think it's possible she already had it when Mando came to get her initially. I don't know. It just like it was too reminiscent of that blue teal color from the planet for it to not be from there.
Yeah.
And so it either she went back to get a new outfit or she just already had it and we didn't see it at the end of season one. But she cleans up this room here, gets rid of all these criminals, rescues the lava rat, and you find that she's picking up all these stolen materials to bring them back to wherever they stole them from. And it was a great action-packed opening sequence. And then we cut to the opening credits. And as we come back, Mando is approaching Nevarro. He lands on the planet much more successfully than at the beginning of the last episode. There was no re-entry sequence, fireball. But he does land and kind of like like plops down on the ground and the rear lift gate doesn't open super well. He has to kind of hop down from it.
I'm surprised he didn't just like jump just to force the thing back down.
Yeah. I was kind of waiting for him to do something like that. But as he lands, Greef Karga and Cara Dune are walking up to greet him. Greef Karga like immediately drops into like this grandpa role of like, hey, like here's like he's holding the kid and cuddling him. And he's like, look how big you are. Is your dad taking good care of you?
he looks very distinguished with that, with the gray beard.
Yeah. And they, as they're walking into so Greef Karga kind of signals to the two mechanics who are nearby, just sitting in the dirt for some reason. He's like, you gotta, like they had no mechanic shop. What was the deal with that? They're just sitting there in the dirt.
Just waiting for some ships to show up.
Yeah. But he's like, look, you need to repair it. You know, Mando's like, do I have good credit here? And he's like, yeah, we'll take care of you. And there's like the camera hangs on one of the two mechanics for just like an extra second, which is a little mysterious at the moment and comes back later.
Very, very suspicious.
Yeah, very suspicious. So they walk into town. It's a lot more of a vibrant city at this point. And it's Mando comments, you've really cleaned this place up. Trade seems to be very active. There's a lot more like positive energy. Even the way the scene was shot and lit, you know, they were, before it was always like a dreary, dark planet. And, you know, the sun is shining now. And, you know, not that they made the sunshine, but just the way that it's framed is like, this place is much more.
Yeah, vibrant. There's a lot of more energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as they walk through, they head to what was the former, you know, bounty hunter bar that they were holed up in and got like burned out, where they were making their escape from Moff Gideon. And I don't know if you noticed, like as they were walking in, you like that square in front of them where, you know, all of the troopers were in the, at the end of the first season, they've built a statue of IG-11. Mm-hmm. Did you see that?
That was very tough. That was very touching.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only there for a split second, so it's easy to miss, but that's a very nice detail to add.
Yeah. I thought that was a really cool, you know, tribute, a really cool tribute to, kind of a hero of the town. So, but they walk in and Mando makes a comment like, "Oh, I didn't even think this place would still be standing." And Carr's like, "Well, wait till you see it. They've converted it into a school," which I thought was kind of cool, clever. There's, a protocol droid teaching up at the front and at the moment teaching about intergalactic trade routes. They said the Hydean Way is like one of the major shipping routes. I feel like that's been mentioned times before, either in Rebels or Solo.
I think the droid was actually talking about the Kessel Run, because I think it name drops the word Kessel in its lecture, if I remember correctly, and it's talking about the Maelstrom. So you think he's talking? I think it's a definitely callback to.
Okay, that's kind of what flight. I was thinking. Yeah, it was cool, and I think this is the first time we've seen education in Star Wars that wasn't about the Jedi, and didn't end in Anakin Skywalker killing all of them. So it was nice to see that.
It's nice to see Youngling still alive. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. And then Grief's like, "Look, let's chat for a minute. We'll leave the kid here." And, you know, Mando's like, no, wherever he goes, I go. And they're like, "No, he's going to be fine here. And you don't want him coming where we're asking you to go." And there's this like great bit of the kid sitting in like a desk in the school, and the guy next to him is eating cookies, and
clearly they're macaroons. Clearly this kid has excellent taste in cookies.
Yeah. And, they're this like light teal color, which is cool. And, he's like the child, you know, obviously doesn't speak, but is motioning towards the kid and like even like holds his hand out at one point, like, "Huh?" And the kid's like, "No." And he gets distracted, looks away, and at that moment, like, the child is using the force to grab his own sleeve of Girl Scout macaroons, and it cuts back to him and he's eating it. And it's just, I don't know, it's such a great moment. I feel like they almost designed some of these scenes for product placement. Like I'm, it's almost unfortunate they didn't actually have the label.
Actually, yes. No, I think it's confirmed that William Sonoma is selling these cookies, these blue macaroon cookies now with the Star Wars trademark on it.
Yeah. So we've got the JCPenney knitted sweater. Now we've got the William Sonoma cookies. I'm just waiting to see what the next thing is.
Boba tea.
So while the kid's eating cookies, they go back to Grief Karga's office, and lo and behold, we meet the Mithril again, who we last saw frozen in carbonite at the very beginning of the first episode. It was interesting to me to find out that the bounty on his head was Grief Karga's own bounty. Like, he used to work for Grief Karga, managing the finances accountant? Of the planet.
Why would you want to? It's like, oh, I thought he was like stealing stocks or something. No, he just didn't want to show up to work anymore.
What? Yeah, I got the sense that he mismanaged the money or stole it in some way, and that possibly Grief Karga put out the bounty, and that's how we were introduced to him initially. But he decided to thaw him out of the carbonite and offer him a sort of a payback plan. I mean, he has a life debt of like 300 years. I guess I don't know how long a Mithril lives, but I'm assuming it's less than 300 years. So this is for sure a life debt to Grief Karga. And so rather than being frozen in carbonite or stuck in jail, he at least has his freedom to work as the accountant again. But Grief Karga and Kara, What it's a great life. He's bossed around the whole episode. Like, no respect for him whatsoever. I was waiting for Horatio Sands to do a. Yeah, I was waiting for him to do a Rodney Dangerfield bit. It's like, I get no respect, okay. So, Greef Karga and Cara Dune break down why they've pulled him aside and what they want to talk to him about. And they basically bring up, you know, another hologram of the planet. They're like, this whole area is safe, but over here, and it zooms in, like, there's this Imperial forward operating base. It's not huge, but there's still a couple of troopers there. They haven't abandoned it. We don't understand why. And, you know, we need to get rid of it in order to make Nevarro truly free. And even Greef Karga talks about his vision for Nevarro becoming like a trade anchor in the Outer Rim. Like, he's clearly a smart guy and, you know, a good, mm-hmm. like, government leader. So he's got, you know, he sees what the potential is for this planet. And basically they want Mando to come with them to take out whatever else is there and overload the reactor that's running it and basically blow up, vaporize the whole place.
Yeah, sounds like a good plan.
I was looking at this. I don't know if like you had your architect glasses on, but this base is built into the mountain. Mm-hmm. But it's near the surface of the mountain, but it's still like, it seems like it's 20 or 30 feet below a surface, but also into the side of the canyon. Like, mm-hmm. I was just imagining, how do you excavate the inside of that mountain to build a facility like that?
In Clone Wars and in Rebels, they've shown structures like that before.
Yeah.
How do they do it? I have no idea. But when you have enough, if you're the Empire with enough money and enough slave labor, you can do anything.
I guess that's fair.
I mean, at the very least, they used very green technology by using the molten core for thermodynamic energy. At least that much could, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if this was a LEED certified structure.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you talk about, we're just talking about how poorly it's maybe built. So the next scene is them heading out to the facility. They're riding in the Mithril's land speeder. And when they get there, you know, and there's this banter back and forth about, he thinks he's like, I'll drop you off here. I'll stay far away. And he's like, no, you're going to get us all the way there. And he keeps like offering to knock a couple of years off of his life debt each time.
They just say like 100 years, I'll knock off 100 years. Oh, okay, only 200 more years to go, boss.
Right. It's kind of flippantly offering two lifetimes worth of years off of his debt. But he rolls them up to the entrance on at least the floor of the canyon. You can look up above at the rim of the canyon, and there's like this super, it's like a 400-foot cantilevered surface. Again, back to architecture and structure. I don't know how that thing is levitating. I suppose it could have its own like whatever hover engines, the way that their ships levitate, but whatever. Giant
space
overlook,
man.
Yeah,
you never question it.
Yeah, so they kind of try to get in, but it's clear that the like controls have melted, and they can't get in. The Mithril goes back. Well, and it's just like funny comment about how cheap everything in the Empire is.
Who thought it was a good idea to put the only electronics to man the only elevator that takes you to and from the top of the platform to have it close to lava and not like enclose it or make it out of lava proof heat resistant materials?
It's insane.
They hired some pretty cheap contractors that day.
Yeah. And you know, they so Mando is looking for his own solution to get in. He jetpacks up above. As he's doing that, the Mithril goes back to the speeder and grabs, I can't remember what they said it was called.
It's like a plasma torch or something.
Yeah, like a plasma cutter of some kind. He says it's like, it's only rated for plumbing mm-hmm. use. It's clearly just like a pretty common tool, almost like a wrench is what it kind of felt like. It's just like, it's mm-hmm. a real simple tool, but he's trying to like, cut into the panel so he can maybe hardwire and open it. And as he's doing that and kind of complaining, he's just complaining the whole time. you can hear blaster bolts above. Mando's obviously come in contact with somebody, and then you hear this like screaming sound that slowly gets closer. It is and like the guy slams on the ground right next to them, the stormtrooper, and then the door opens to the lift. The quick conversation here, they're like, all right, well, let's get in. The Mithril's like, I'm going to hop in the cruiser. You know, just give me a call. I'll swing back by when you need me. No big deal. And they're like, no, you're coming with, you can't go. He's like, if you don't want to come in, you can stay out here. They talk about how this fish person can get around a planet, which he's wearing like a humidity vest, like basically it's like a space suit, I guess, for moisture to keep his body, you know,
the
controlled.
The first time he sees the Mando again, when we see the Mithril again.
Oh, yeah.
He has like the equivalent of like, I don't know, peeing on himself. All of a sudden, there's all this steam just jets from his neck. Like,
that was great. Oh.
So, yeah. They mentioned something about a lava tide. Like,
yeah.
Don't stay too long.
Like, lava tide. So I guess it's one thing for this to be like a volcanic planet with lava flowing out of like holes in the core and the crust of the planet. But it seems like there's like a lava ocean, and it just like, as the moon rotates around, it pulls the lava back and forth. I'm not going to do Bill O'Reilly impression here, but no one knows what makes the lava tides come in and out. They just go.
I got an idea. Let's build our super military base on top of lava. That'll be fine. No problems there if we see whatsoever.
So he's convinced he's not going to wait out in the lava tide for them. They go up in the lift. As they get up there, Mando's like, so this is abandoned, huh? And there's like 7 or 8 troopers all laid out on the ground.
This is a callback back to when he talked to Navarro, and he's like, oh, only 4 guys, right? Yeah, well, 4 guys on him. Like, thanks Grief.
Right. Yeah. There's always more troopers on Navarro. So the Mithril is kind of, he's starting to look at what's up here. He calls out like a mint condition Trexler Marauder, which we saw in Rebels. It's this cool, like, troop transport. I think we see it in Rogue One too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. It's a version of this is what is carrying her in the prison camp when she gets freed. Spoiler alert. But
I think so. But yeah, it's basically an armored transport.
Yeah. And you can tell, like, it's like covered in a tarp, but the fact that it gets name checked here, you know that it's going to come into play at some point later in the episode. We cut up to the the bridge or the control room of this base, and you know, a classic Imperial officer, you know, dressed with his hat and everything. The security camera for that level where they are is out. It's fuzzy. He's calling for them. He's like, you know, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Shuttle bay coming. And then all of a sudden, a car comes behind and gets a death grip on him. I guess probably we'll just say he passed out, but they drop him to the ground.
Yeah, he'll be fine. He'll be fine.
Then they hack into the computer to try to see, so that, you know, obviously their goal here is to overload the core, whatever that means, and destroy the base. And Mando punches in some directions, finds out where to go. They head out. As they're going, a pair of troopers walk by, and they said the term TK-147, right? And I think isn't that the name call from A New Hope when they're on the Death Star and taking like Han and Chewie to the prison cell?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's definitely a callback.
All right. That's what I thought. So that it was just an interesting little, you know, callback to the series, but I liked, I thought I heard it and I had to go back and listen again to make sure I was right. And then so that they're going, they take out a couple of the troopers, they get this little like cigar shaped piece, which is clearly used for interacting with the computer. It seems like it's just a key of some kind, obviously like more of an encrypted key or something like that. but or I guess they got that from the guy in the control room. But Greef Karga specifically calls it out. He's like, this is going to come in handy. As they make their way through the base, it felt a little bit like the episode 6 from season 1 with on the prison ship, the kind of like repetitive corridors that all look the same.
Yeah.
It's definitely like an Imperial aesthetic.
I honestly thought they were just, with the camera shots and the hallways all looking so similar, I thought they were just going to bump into each other again. Like, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Exits this way. I'll be back. Sorry, guys. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oops, we walked too far on set. We're on the old set. We got to get off. So they make it to the room where they're headed. They stick the little encrypted key into the pad. It opens the door and they come out on the platform and look down this giant shaft into like a lava pit essentially. Mm-hmm. And you know, this was interesting to me. One, I'm not sure what this shaft is, if it's a naturally occurring like lava vent for like some kind of, you know, volcanic activity. It seems more intentionally built, but I'm not quite sure why. But down at the bottom of the shaft where the lava was like pooled together were a couple of like, I don't know, plasma looking generators, which look a lot like the stuff that's on Mustafar from, mm-hmm. you know, the Revenge of the Sith, that like protected the mining equipment from being injured by the lava. It looked like it was sort of holding the lava at bay. Did you get that sense?
I got the sense that that was their core and they harnessed lava, or the heat at least from lava for thermodynamic energy. I think that's what's powering, because later on when they talk about, when they talk about like releasing the coolant in a second, and because right now the Mithril, he does slice the computer and they start talking about draining the coolant lines. That would be a bad thing. They do not want to drain the coolant lines because then the pit of lava would overheat, so to speak. And then, you know, that would not be good for the facility.
Yeah. So, you know, Greef Karga is like, you got to go overload the core. And they kind of called out a criticism of some of the earlier Star Wars films and like the Death Star, when like there's like a little catwalk over an infinite cavern and there's no guardrail of any kind. They make fun of it in the Family Guy movie. I mean, anything that's ever parodied Star Wars makes fun of the fact that there's no guardrails on Imperial facilities. And as Horatio Sands is like stepping down. Yeah.
Like, you want me to just stand here on this 2-foot clearance over this 1,000-foot drop into pure lava and not even give me a decent guardrail? Like, that's how you know there's no OSHA in space.
Oh, yeah. Like, he's like, kind of stepping. He's like, there's no guardrail here. Just like, just go. And I love that moment. he goes around, goes to the computer. He tries to operate it. It doesn't work. He tries sticking in the encrypted key, and that makes it work. I looked at the panel. There was some text in Orabesh at the top of it. It just said core temp, which is the graphic made that very obvious of what it was actually saying. But it's just interesting to, now that I have like gotten more keyed into Orabesh as a language, I'm trying to like dissect it anywhere I see it. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a good moment to plug our recent merch upgrade. We have available in our Etsy shop a bunch of show swag that just says "This is the way" in Orabesh, and it's a pretty cool looking font, and we're pretty happy about it. So you can check that out. But now that I have that all in my mind, everywhere I see it, I start to translate it. So he slices into the computer, shuts down the coolant lines, and you know, the base alarms go off. So now everybody's alerted to at least a problem, if not the fact that someone may be here. And you know, they head back into the building, and they come across some other stormtroopers, get in a couple of firefights, and that kind of redirects the way that they don't go out the same way they came in. And so I guess while the gang is looking for a new way out of the facility, why don't we just take a quick break, and it'll give us a chance to hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
This episode of Death Watch is also brought to you by Skull Square Design Company. We're also huge fans of The Mandalorian, as well as Star Wars in general. And we wanted to share that love by making gifts for our fellow fans of Mando and the Child. Whether you wanted some flair while enjoying your favorite beverage in Oga's Cantina, or wanted to covertly show your support to the Resistance while exploring Batuu, we've got gifts for everybody. And not just Star Wars fans, but Marvel and Disney fans too. Check us out at skullsquared.com or follow us on social media at skullsquared. That's skull with a C, as in,
see y'all real soon.
And we're back. So Mike is going to have to step out for a second, but he'll be joining us on the rest of the episode at the end. So the crew stumbles upon two scientists slash engineers, and they are attempting to wipe their hard drive. And I have never understood why it is that in an attempt to wipe their hard drives, they always have to like smash and grab the physical drives. I never understood why it is that they just don't download to the cloud like normal people do nowadays, but whatever. I want to give a thanks to listener Lego My Rego, because she pointed out that there was on the screen what appeared to be plans for Starkiller Base. I can't really confirm that. It does seem pretty interesting. So if any of you look into it and can confirm it for us, let us know. That'd be pretty interesting. Pretty interesting callback, which will probably tie in to what we theorize, what we'll see in the rest of the scene. What's going on. I'd like to also point out that one of the engineers is clearly playing on a Game Boy or Sega Game Gear, some sort of handheld console. He's like not doing his job. He's like, okay, I gotta stress play, you know, before we dip. But the crew shows up, firefight ensues. One of the techs goes down before the console gets shot up, but by the looks of it, not completely destroyed. And I also just want to, you know, give a shout out to our friend, the Mithril, who I think from now on I'm going to call him Gills McGee. Actually could take a couple of shots on his own. So the crew shows up, techs are down, but then there's this moment, this kind of tense moment where they walk up to the back to tanks, and then the mood, the sound changes, and they're all looking at this eerie blue glow, and they don't know what's going on. And well, several listeners, we want to thank Amy, Larissa, Papa Makito. They all noticed that it's this very monotone music. Potentially, it's the Snoke's. It is Snoke's theme music. So what does this mean? What are we looking in? There's these strange, warped, mutated type creatures. We did a poll, so we want to thank everybody who participated in our wrong answers poll. But a lot of people have theorized that what they could actually be is an attempt at the Snoke clones that we see later on in The Rise of Skywalker. We know, confirmed, that Snoke is a type of clone of some kind, or some sort of creature, or strand cast, as they call it in the show. But we don't actually know at this point. All we know is that the crew is not liking what they're seeing. So this is definitely not some sort of Ford operating base. I like how Gills McGee likes to call back to the fact like, hey, isn't the reactor like about to blow? So suddenly they have this extra time in their hands to like look at the records. But anyway, I like the fact that when Kara screams at him, he like does this like squelching sound, because he's, you know, got gills. So it lets him know that he's a pretty nervous person, fish person. So he goes over, he politely pushes off the dead tech. And he starts playing, he pushes a couple of buttons, and he starts playing a recording. And it's the good doctor Pershing, who we've seen in the first season. So he's still got a job, thankfully, good for him. He starts talking about how the experiments have failed. They had initial success after 2 weeks, or if you don't not aware of what a fortnight is, it's 2 weeks. But then there's catastrophic failure. They reject these transfusions.
I highly doubt we'll find a donor with a higher M count, though. I recommend that we suspend all experimentation. I fear that the volunteer will meet the same regrettable fate if we proceed with the transfusion. Unfortunately, we have exhausted our initial supply of blood.
He starts he drops the name M Count, which we can all surmise is related to midichlorians, which were mentioned in the prequel movies. It's basically how you gauge the force abilities in a Jedi. It is obviously talking about the child, talking about how when Mando first rescued him and he was on the bed, and Dr. Pershing was able to extract some blood from him. For what purpose at that time, we did not know. Now we finally realize what the child was being used for. And unfortunately, as per Dr. Pershing's message, it implies that Gideon is going to need to get it again if they want these experiments to continue. So Mando's like, that's impossible. Moff Gideon is dead. Gills basically checks the records and say, well, no, this recording is only 3 days old. We knew that as the audience, but now Mando knows and he needs to bail. So more troopers show up in the corridor, another firefight. Gills actually gets one shot in and he makes it count. And then Mando needs to jet, literally. So he needs to get the kid and head out. So the rest of the crew is pretty much on their own right now. So now they get on their way out. More corridor firefights. Honestly, I thought they were going to bump into each other again because of the fact that all these corridors start looking the same. But that's Empire architecture for you. So Mando gets back to the reactor, which kind of looks like a jacuzzi at this point. Doesn't have time to, you know, stay and relax. So he supermans his way out. But before he does, he gets a couple of shots. Some troopers get shots off of his Beskar armor. He's able to shoot back and then he blasts off. Gets up to the top of the plateau, basically the opening where the reactor core was. And we see once again the famed TIE Outlanders that Moff Gideon showed up in the last episode, or second to last episode rather, of season one. But we also saw in the trailer. So it's obvious that this is the scene that we saw in the trailer where the Empire was holed up on. It wasn't some other location. They were on Navarro this entire time. So it's possible we're going to see these TIE Outlanders again. So Mando blasts off and seemingly off screen. We jump back to our motley crew, our sidekicks. And one thing I've never understood about the Star Wars universe that has always irked me is that nothing is ever labeled. Like, everyone magically knows that the two button color scheme that is on every console, red button, white button, like they know the exact combination. There's no open, close, on, off. It's more like red button, white button, other white button. That is the exact combination to open the cargo door. So they make their way over to the platform, trying to make their way back to the elevator and head out, but they get intersected with some stormtroopers and they're pinned. They gotta hide behind some crates, another firefight. Kara gets an idea to commandeer the transport, the pristine mint condition transport that we saw earlier that we totally did not think they would use again in this episode, but now that they are. Something I like to note is the stormtroopers, that when they talk, when you hear them, they sound like old-timey radio announcers. Like, their voice is kind of like that that mono audio recording, like, hey, shoot them, blast them, over there, get them, you know. So she grabs the boys once she gets the transport, but on their way out, unfortunately, door closes, so they can't go that way. So she does this Tokyo drift, spins around 180, and they both look at her and they're like, no, you're not going to do it. And she's got this look on her face that's like, yeah, of course I'm going to do it. She's a drop trooper after all. So she basically punches it full speed, almost takes a couple of troopers with her, jump off the cliff. Wilhelm screams all the way down and then crash lands on top of Gil's speeder. So goodbye, speeder. So they make their way down and then speeder squad shows up out of nowhere. Five make their way out, also try to make an attempt to jump off the platform. Unfortunately, two of them didn't get the memo that this was very rocky terrain, hit each other, and only three make it down to the lava flat. And this is yet another scene that we saw in the trailer of the speeders on their way over to chase somebody. Now we realize it's the three sidekicks in the armored transport. So Grief Karga gets the idea of running up to the gunner position. Very familiar to the original trilogy, Han Solo and Luke showing up to the basically to the blaster, cheers, demand the gunner positions. He takes the gunner position in the back. He's able to at least take one speeder out, but then the remaining two decide to flank them, which in theory would be a pretty smart move if it wasn't for the fact that the speeder if it didn't have the weight of, like, I don't know, a crumpled up paper ball versus an armored tank, but, you know, whatever, at least they tried. So Kara is able to careen one of the speeders into some boulder, getting close to the rock face, and takes him out. But the last guy has the bright idea of mounting and climbing on top of the armor truck so that he can attempt to breach and clear with a thermal detonator. Cargo's looking around in the gunner position, like, where did this guy go? Finally turns around 180 and he sees him in his scope, and our scout trooper gets breached instead. So the reactor finally blows. This is like the longest 10 minutes ever. And these guys, our crew is like, you know, they're happy. They're like, fine, you know, we got away. But at that point, just before the entire base actually blows up, the four TIE Outlanders launch. So our guys think they're in the clear until we hear the familiar screeching of the TIE fighters. So Karga is trying to hit them, but, you know, they're aerial targets, so it's kind of hard to miss when you're on the ground and they're sort of zigzagging in the literal trench run. So I couldn't tell if he was, like, trying to shoot at them directly, or he was making an attempt to, like, shoot the rock cliffs, so maybe knock out the TIE fighters. Either way, he's not doing a great job knocking them out. So he goes and he yells at Kara and he gives her the token. Can you make this armored vehicle tank thing that normally goes slow go any faster? And in her frustration, she punches it and they attempt to flee. They're hitting some rock faces on their way out. So Karga finally takes one out, the one that's closest to him, but unfortunately a barrel rolls into their position, into the rear of the armored transport, and knocks out their guns. Karga is able to get out of the gunner position with enough time before he got burned. So right now they're just an armored truck, no weapons. They got some speed, but they got three TIE fighters on their tail. So they get out of the trench. They finally make their way to the clearing on their way to town. And TIE fighters are not able to hit them, but just as they're about to make their second pass, they can see right in front of them, the three coming in and making a pass formation, blaster fire comes out, and it's Mando coming to save the day. He takes out one ship. We get a scene in the cockpit, and Child is hanging on, hands in the air like he just don't care, with his little macaroon snacky. So the crew finally gets to the gate of Navarro. They park the car. They get out to watch the remaining dogfight, and the Child continues to eat his snacks. So Mando does this really cool move where he basically is following the TIE fighter and they're just climbing straight 90 degrees into the atmosphere. He finally takes it out and then he drifts, basically positions it where there's an initial free fall. So he's facing downward again towards the last remainder. Then he just punches the engine, starts the barrel roll. TIE fighter has him in his scopes and is taking his shot. Mando waits to the last minute till he's close enough to use his forward-facing guns and take out the last TIE. And at that point, Mando turns around and he goes, yeah, that was pretty fun, right? And the Child totally baby Groots it, and Blue Macaroon vomits all over herself. Cute. So Greef Karga comes on the comm and says, why don't you come down? Can't. Mando says, I got some onboard maintenance, which I think is now code for parents when they have to deal with their kids' messy issues. I'm sure Mike can relate to that. So Mando says, what do I owe you? He goes, well, no, I'm sorry. Greef goes, so what do I owe you? He's like, well, for the repairs, we'll call it even. So Mando blasts off and leaves Kara and Karga and Gilles McGee back in Navarro. Next scene, we actually open up to the gates again in Navarro, presumably it's a different day because we open up to a pair of X-Wings that are parked right outside. And we're met again with Captain Carsativa, who we saw earlier initially chasing down, but then sort of not really saving Mando with the spiders. So he's there on official business as a sort of an officer. He's investigating the events from what happened with the base. Karga's just sitting on his desk. You know, he's got his feet up. He's playing coy. He is not directly mentioning anything related to Mando or the crest. He goes, what are you talking about? Those droids, you know, they can't tell the difference between what's pre-Empire and what's not. So he's not really giving Karsa Teva the information that Teva probably already knows. So he lets him out, like, you know, if I find out anything for you, I'll send you a gram, which is, I think, their sort of version of, you know, I'll send you a text. I'll send you a message via the internet. So Cara Dune, the new marshal, she's outside. She's feeding her new pet, the lava rat that she sort of rescued earlier. Captain Teva comes up and essentially he tries to recruit her. Says, you know, we can always use your help, or someone with skill set like yours. She mentions, she says something interesting. She goes, I'm not a joiner, Blue. Probably, you know, I'm not a recruiter. I'm not a soldier anymore. Probably referring to him, I'm not entirely sure. Could be because he belongs to Blue Squadron. If anyone can fill in the gaps there, why she would have called him a Blue when the Rebels were definitely had a red color scheme going. But I don't know. My theory is that he's probably like Blue Squadron or something similar. So before he goes, he mentions to her that there's something going on, that the core worlds won't admit it, but there's definitely something happening in the outer reaches, and that these are not isolated incidents. We don't exactly know what he's referring to. I'm theorizing that these skirmishes related to Empire remnants, that are being led by, maybe they don't know it's being led by Gideon, but by somebody similar. They recognize that there are still threats to the New Republic. But I'm also theorizing that they could also be referring to a more coordinated effort, a larger effort, such as the First Order, which I've always wondered in the events of Force Awakens, how did nobody see this coming? New Republic was always established. How did they not know that there was this large, formidable army? Did they know and just not care? Or did they really come out of nowhere with some help on the side, which we eventually find out is the Emperor? So he mentions to her, he mentions the fact that he knows, he checked her records, that she's originally from Alderaan. He asks, did you lose anybody? There's a moment and she goes, I lost everybody. We know what happened to Alderaan in episode 4, New Hope. Death Star blows up Princess Leia's planet of Alderaan. Does this come back? Do we get this sense that she gets reminded because of the fact that she lost everybody, that now she wants to continue bringing the fight to him, to the Empire? We don't know. Before he leaves with her with some sort of a medal. Clearly has the Republic insignia on it, very shiny, maybe as a token of gratitude and appreciation for her service. But as the camera pans out and Captain Teva walks away, we see Cara Dune in the street and she's got her fist balled up. Maybe she's thinking about it. Maybe she's thinking that, okay, the quiet life isn't really for me. When we first initially saw her on Sorgan, she just kind of wanted to get away and sort of lay low. But maybe this is an opportunity for her to finally bring the fight back to the people who deserve it. So hopefully we'll see in the rest of the series what they have in store for her. So cut to space, and now we have a familiar shot of the bad guy's underbelly ship. This is not a Star Destroyer. This is a smaller ship. It's the Arquitans class command cruiser. Definitely Imperial. Almost looks like a modified or similar design to the Venator class that we used to see in the Clone Wars movies. Clone Wars series, rather. So an officer comes up to the desk, opens up a hologram, and it's the suspicious snitch that we saw from earlier, the mechanic who had eyes on Mando. Evidently, he placed a bug that he had planted on the crest. So the commander gives him empty thank you. We will pay you in the future when we win. Not right now. Thank you. She walks off. She goes down a corridor and she reports directly to Moff Gideon. So he asks, do they still have the asset? After she tells him, yes, the tracking device was planted on the crest. He asks, does he still have the asset? And she goes, our sources say yes. And then with a smile, he concludes, we will be ready. To what he's referring to exactly, we don't know. But what we see immediately right after, he turns around, camera pans into what it is that he was initially looking at, and it's a corridor full of dark armored robots, droids. Could they be suits? We don't know. A lot of people have been speculating they're dark troopers. It's very ominous. We can discuss more of the dark troopers offline. You can give us your theories as to what exactly was in this closet that he was working on, his sweats. Does this involve the midichlorians? How does this involve the things that we saw and the Bacta tanks? We really don't know. So, Mike, how are you feeling about this episode so far? What was your favorite part?
Well, I mean, I think this was a really action-packed episode, which I thought was cool, even like from the beginning with Cara Dune in the covert, and then the whole sequence in the Imperial base was just a lot of cool action. The TIE fighter sequence was pretty cool. And then the whole Top Gun moment at the end with Maverick and Goose.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of action here. And then, I mean, there's just like such a significant reveal here with the cloning. You know, we've suspected it all along. It seems like they're leaning into it a lot more and it's becoming part of the primary storyline. It's crazy. There's now like several long-term story elements that keep Boba Fett is still a thing who we saw, but like he hasn't shown up at all. So he'll probably come back at some point. You know, obviously we're going to meet, Ahsoka at some point, I mean, likely this next week. And those will probably merge at some point with Ahsoka and, Moff Gideon. But, you know, then there's Bo-Katan and the rest of her Mandalorian clan and the Mandalorians in general. So there's like a lot of story elements that are unconnected, but probably will get connected, that, you know, will be interesting to see.
At the very least, I feel like they're also helping to fill in gaps, kind of like how Rebels and Clone Wars did between the main movies and the main storyline. There's some elements that we're missing, and this also has the potential to tie in to the new trilogy, to Force Awakens.
Yeah, we were talking this could end up being like a giant retcon for the origins of Snoke and the like revival of the Emperor.
What I liked about this episode, and I noted, was that this is the least Mando centric episode, I feel like, in the series. Like this episode has been about the sidekicks more so than the main character. Like he comes in to save the day like at the last second.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's about the development of, it's basically the Grief Karga show.
Yeah.
Versus some dude in silver armor.
Yeah. There was one thing we forgot to mention earlier in the episode. During the cold open, they're sipping some soup, likely, and Mando is lifting up his mask to drink it.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's only a partial reveal. You can see like his chin or something like that. But I kind of
didn't realize that the helmet could open that
way. Well, I kind of feel like it is a little bit of like almost like an incremental progression for Mando of like he wouldn't eat around people before, even around the kid. Like if he was offered food in very normal scenarios and he'd be like, I'm not going to eat because I can't take my helmet off. And now, you know, obviously the kid is like his child. And so maybe there's some more like, because it's a deeper relationship, maybe it's different. But I think because he's met Bo-Katan and it's been seeded in him that the Mandalorians themselves don't take off their, or that they do take off their helmets in general, that maybe he's like loosening a little bit on that. I couldn't tell if that was part of it or if it just, if maybe it, his clan no, always I like ate I like by it. Taking their helmets like that.
No, I kind of like that point that you're bringing out. Like, he's warming up to the idea that this is one of his own now.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very, I don't want to say sensitive, but a very personal thing for him to do.
Yeah. So we, the other thing too is that, like, this whole, you know, they didn't say it all the way, but name checking the midichlorians, or they called it the M count, was, yeah, I think, you know, mm-hmm, interesting.
We know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's I think that was a criticism of the prequels, was like this whole bringing in this idea that you could like measure the anatomy of a Jedi person, of a force sensitive person. But, you know, now they're bringing it into a different context and how to use that information as opposed to just like measuring it in a person. And it'll be, you know, I had one idea that maybe even Moff Gideon is attempting to infuse other people with midichlorian blood from the child to see if it takes, so that maybe he himself could inject it in him to like give himself force abilities. That, like,
interesting.
He's got this, you know,
that is very interesting.
He's got the darksaber, lightsaber, and, you know, maybe he has this, you know, desire to be a force wielding, you know, Sith. I think that would be, it's like, so it's not just that he's maybe like, there's this idea that maybe these were Snoke or the Emperor, or this is all technology being developed to lay the groundwork for reviving the Emperor for the later films. But I also wonder if this is just a total separate thing of like, that was technology developed maybe for the Emperor's revival, but maybe Moff Gideon is like trying to take a different turn with it and use it for his own gain. Maybe he wants to be the Emperor and he's not just trying to serve someone else.
That is a very interesting theory. That's the first time I've heard that.
We'll see.
But that does seem kind of plausible for evil empire, take advantage of everybody, put myself in power kind of.
Totally.
You know, situation.
So I want to give a few shout outs. We put up a wrong answers only poll this week, which was pretty fun. Chris put up the picture of the Bacta tank with the humanoid thing inside. And we said, who do you think this is? Wrong answers only. We got some hilarious responses back from Honorary Android, Souffle Girl 18, Timotry, that nerdy running fit mom, Tamaji 808, David Essel, Peter Pan Cottage.
Esley,
thank you.
Sorry, David.
No, yeah, sorry about that. Peter Pan's Cottage, Rooks Jeff, Papa Marquito, It's Chow Time, Rhodes Photographs, Lego My Rego, E-Prez, Ray the Realtor, and Max F1997, and Skold Squared. Thanks all of you for reaching out and sharing your thoughts. They were hilarious. And we hope you'll continue to respond back in future polls. It's we love hearing from you guys.
And that's all for this episode. So thank you for joining us.
If you like this episode, please subscribe and share, and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps our show move up in the show rankings and allows other people to find us and listen to us.
Also, please follow us on Instagram at Death Watch Podcast, or also on Twitter at Death Watch Cast. If you have any comments, any omissions or suggestions for upcoming episodes, you can email us at deathwatchpodcast@gmail.com, and we'd love to feature it on future episodes.
Thanks for listening. This is the way.
This is the way.